Welcome to episode 142 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hello, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. There's a lot that's going on this week, but for those who have a historical bent, on this day 60 years ago was the assassination of President Kennedy. For many of our generation, I was only seven when this happened, but many of our generation know where they were at that time. I was living in England, and so there wasn't as much coverage, although it was still quite the shock. What I remember most about that day is not JFK's assassination, but the following day was the inaugural broadcast of Doctor Who.
So in this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want to get them all, over about 250 a year, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus, where you get a poem every day, plus a great primary care reference. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed in Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any products. For a little nominal annual fee, you can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Go to IAFP.com and click on their online education webpage. This week, we're going to talk about third trimester Tdap for prevention of pertussis in infants, atogepant for preventing migraines, POCUS for diagnosing small bowel obstruction, and medications for treating gastroparesis. Kate.
Hey, so this week I have the study about Tdap and how effective it is for preventing infant pertussis when given to pregnant people. So Tdap at 28 weeks gestation is a routine recommendation in pregnancies in both the US and Australia. That fact will become important in a second. It's been shown to increase antibodies and reduce infection in newborns, but there's been some question about whether vaccination during pregnancy could reduce the infant's ability to mount its own immune response when they get their own vaccinations during early childhood, during early infancy. So this study actually asks the questions, what is the effectiveness of intra-pregnancy vaccination against pertussis and future infant risk of disease? And does that third trimester vaccination actually decrease the effectiveness of infant vaccination? So this was a retrospective cohort study done, as I mentioned, in Australia. It was done in three, I think they're territories. I'm not actually sure what the jurisdiction, Queensland, Northern Territory, and Western Australia, using health records databases. And part of the reason I was excited to talk about this study is just because of the really cool sort of national health methodology that they were able to use here. So they had almost 280,000 parent-child dyads, which was about a third of all infants born in Australia included in this study. They included any infants with a gestational age greater than 28 weeks, which well precedes viability, and a birth weight greater than 400 grams they included. The majority of information collected was included as part of these big administrative databases in these three jurisdictions. They were collecting this as part of these ongoing perinatal health cohorts as part of their efforts to reduce perinatal mortality. So all of the information like gestational age, maternal vaccination status, birth outcomes, labor and delivery data, a lot of other relevant information were already included in these national databases. As in the U.S., infant vaccination status is recommended against pertussis is recommended at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. And infant vaccination status was also extracted from a national immunization database, which they have over there. Information about pertussis infection was also gleaned from national databases because, as in the U.S., pertussis is a reportable disease, at least as in Illinois. I assume it is in most other jurisdictions in the U.S. So about half of patients had a pertussis vaccination during pregnancy. I'm not actually sure what our rates are in the U.S., but that felt low. The majority happening as recommended at or after 28 weeks of gestation. There were 331 pertussis cases reported in the first 18 months of life in the surveilled infants. 119 cases in infants of vaccinated parents compared with 212 among infants of unvaccinated parents. So that's 82 versus 157. That's the rate per 100,000 infants. Vaccination during pregnancy reduced the risk of hospitalization and admission to the ICU. There were two total deaths reported, one in each of those groups. Infant vaccination was also substantially associated with a reduced risk of pertussis. No surprise there. A rate of 19 per 100,000 infants in the cohort with both parental and infant vaccination, compared with 238 per 100,000 in the cohort with neither. Vaccines work, folks. If the infants had received at least two doses of vaccine, the risk was reduced even further. The protection from the gestational dose, the intrapregnancy dose of vaccine, lasted about 8 months, which was actually longer than they expected it to be. This study did find a small reduction in infant vaccine effectiveness from the third dose of DTaP, but not the first or second among the infants, again, whose pregnant parent had gotten that vaccine during pregnancy. And those infants, again, as I said, had an overall much lower risk of pertussis. So even if they found a slightly lower immune response, the risk of infection was lower. So bottom line here, Tdap during pregnancy is effective at reducing infection rate, risk of severe infection, and any blunting of vaccine response. It's offset by either a boost of immunity already present from that gestational dose, or by immunity already present from those first two doses. So that's my data dump on parental gestational pertussis and infant pertussis. Henry.
Good stuff. Yeah, good stuff. Henry, some comments?
Yeah, so how should I say this? So first of all, we've known that moms during pregnancy can be a vector for transmission of that vertical transmission of many potential harms to their infants, whether it's through toxins or infectious diseases. And that's why we do an awful lot of the initial screening that we do is to identify those who have had high risk exposures. I think last episode or the episode before, the magnesium study of administering magnesium to the mother to try to see if we might take advantage of that potential vertical transmission to prevent things, bad things happening to infants. I think this is, we're starting to see a bit more of those kinds of things. So this is kind of interesting notion. I know it raises all kinds of potential ethical concerns. That aside, I do want to just point out that this was not a randomized trial, and so there are lots of potential explanations for this. But the big question is, does this even need a randomized trial? That's not the purpose behind administering Tdap to pregnant women. It's to make sure that they themselves are not harmed. And so this is really looking at, is there any potential harms to the infants, or is there any additional benefit beyond the immediate protection to the mother? So I don't know that we have to have an RCT to answer this question.
Yeah, an RCT in this context would be huge. Even the quote-unquote worst-case scenario was basically about 250 cases per 100,000 infants, right? So an RCT in this situation would probably be impossible to pull off given the low frequency of infection, native infection. The thing that this just strikes me just so impressively, in spite of the fact that most kids, you know, obviously don't get infected. For those who do, my goodness, the protection is crazy good. It goes down from 238 down to 19. I mean, the vaccines, it continues to impress me how powerful in general, but specifically in this case, these vaccines really are in terms of their potential for preventing disease.
All right, vaccines work. Henry, you got a quiz for us?
Yeah, so we're recording the day before Thanksgiving. So by the way, if you are going to be traveling, I hope that you have safe travels and stay away from those crazy uncles and their crazy ideas. But that also means that we are in the middle of the beginning of our cold and flu season. And so this quiz is kind of triggered by a recent FDA advisory. So in September, the FDA advisory committee released conclusions about orally administered phenylephrine. Which of the following statements from that advisory are true? A, phenylephrine is harmful to humans and animals. B, phenylephrine is harmful to children. C, phenylephrine does not shorten the duration of colds. D, phenylephrine is ineffective in alleviating nasal congestion. Stay tuned.
Henry, can it be more than one?
Nope, he's shaking his head, which is
okay. I see that. Yes, I'm sure
listeners, you're not seeing that.
I'm just looking at my stems.
I'm just going to scroll down to the answer and tell you no, it's a single correct answer today.
All right, Henry, it's your turn for the poem as well.
Yeah, so this poem asks whether a toga pant or what? How did you pronounce it, Mark?
I said atogepant.
Okay, whatever.
I don't know. But, yeah, exactly.
I don't either. They make these names up so we can make up the pronunciations. So
this group called G-pants as a class. But
no. Oh, okay, and I call them G-pants. All right. So the big question is whether or not this specific drug is effective in reducing headache frequency in adults with chronic migraine. So this was published in Lancet just a few months ago. So the CGRP receptor antagonists, the so-called gepants or gepants, have been used mostly for treating acute migraine. And this was part of our headache topic in our courses earlier this year. And we're starting to see a few studies thinking that maybe these also play a role in prevention. So that was the focus on this study. The researchers enrolled adults who had at least 1 year of chronic migraines, meaning they had to have at least 15 headache days per month, at least half of which had to be migraine. So there are people who could have had mixed headaches and the like. But they also had to be really, really, really adherent to completing this electronic headache diary during a four-week baseline screening period where they established the rates of for each individual. So just to give you an idea of how select this group was, this took place in 142 centers. They screened about 1,500 potentially eligible participants, okay? Just about half of them failed, okay? So this translated to 142 centers to get about 700 people, so only five or six per headache center. So really, really select group. They randomized them to one of three groups, either a atogepant 30 milligrams twice daily, atogepant 60 milligrams once daily, or placebo. And to try to preserve the blinding, the group that got the once daily medication had a placebo second dose. Okay, so they really tried to make sure that there was adequate blinding. Okay, now there were some other things that, you know, they were allowed to continue with their preventive therapy as long as they were on a stable regimen for at least the 3 months before. And for rescue, they could use anything that was available to them except another gepant. Okay, all right. So what did they find? So at baseline, there were the average rate of headaches was 19 per month. So this was a really miserable group of individuals.
That's awful.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I get one or two a year. So this is I'm nowhere close to this. But so at the end of the study, 16 weeks, what they found was that the average number of migraine days decreased comparably by about 7 days for each of the active treatment groups and about five in the placebo group. So the net difference being about two. But the International Headache Society has some standardized outcome measures, one of which is at least a 50% reduction in headache frequency or migraine days. And in this study, the active intervention group about 40% had that 50% reduction compared to about a quarter of those who got placebo. So that translates into a number needed to treat of about 6 to 7, okay? So pretty reasonable number needed to treat, although in a highly selective group, okay? Slightly more GI side effects, although the dropout rates were comparable among all of the groups, okay? So this stuff's pretty pretty effective, but my gosh, it's expensive. So at goodrx.com, 30 of the 60 milligrams tablets cost over $1,000, and 60 of the 30 milligram tablets are double that. So here's my suggestion. If you've got a patient who has chronic migraines like this, let's try some other therapies such as beta blockers, angiotensin receptor blockers, amitriptyline, anticonvulsants, maybe even botulinum toxin, or even riboflavin. So, you know, riboflavin, there's not a lot of data out there, but there's a 2017 systematic review that identified 11 randomized trials. Five showed consistent reductions in headache frequency in adults. In children and adolescents, the four studies that looked at that, it was kind of mixed. And there were two studies that looked at combination therapies. And so that didn't really have any effect. So I think there's some other options. And this should not be the place we go to first line. This is your backup when you're thinking, well, maybe I might want to send this person off to a center?
Yeah, this would be my sixth line, I think, to try. Actually, a randomized trial on riboflavin for migraine was one of the first poems we ever wrote up about 25 years ago. So yeah, there's a long history of that. So yeah, now studies like this irritate me because they're comparing it to nothing instead of comparing it to something. And there are so many potential comparators that they could have, you know, tried, except that, of course, it probably wouldn't have been better than any of them. And it costs, you know, several car payments per month. So
maybe this is your next network bet analysis.
Yeah, there you go. I'm going to take a break from meta-analysis for a few weeks. Kate, any comments?
Yeah, I do kind of wonder how this made it to the Lancet threshold. You know, yeah, as you said, it's not a spectacular, you know, in terms of applicability to clinical practice, not spectacular kind of trial. I agree, it's a tool in the toolbox. I do think that a lot of people who have chronic or daily migraines have been through a lot of our other therapies. They're not super well tolerated. They're not super effective, in reality. And so I do think having the tool is useful. You know, I think, you know, we know the difference. We know very well the difference between price and cost in American medicine. And so I think, you know, knowing they're $1,000 a tablet does not mean that they're $1,000 a tablet to anyone, except for the few folks who are paying out of pocket, which is almost no one. But I welcome the tool. I wonder what the real world, you know, effectiveness will be.
Yeah. American medicine. I just had the experience of paying for an imaging study because my insurance was screwed up by the University System of Georgia. Thank you for nothing. And they billed me $2,300, which was a discount from the original $3,200 for the imaging. And I asked them, what's the contract rate with Blue Cross Blue Shield? $489. I think I sent a letter or emailed a letter. Anybody writes a letter. I emailed our legislator, who I know here, and said, we need a law that mandates using the contract rate for uninsured patients rather than this six times higher exorbitant ridiculous rate for the people least able to afford it. Anyway, sorry. Sorry to complain, but I'll complain. Hey, that's why we have a podcast, so we can complain. Okay, so I got the next study, and this one is in American Journal of Emergency Medicine. Good journal. They publish a lot of interesting studies. This was a systematic review and individual patient-level meta-analysis of point-of-care ultrasound for small bowel obstruction. Shokuhi was the first author. It was in volume 70, page 144. So this was a meta-analysis, and the authors searched PubMed and the Cochrane database to identify any prospective studies of point-of-care ultrasound, POCUS, performed by ED physicians on adults with suspected small bowel obstruction. So to be included, the studies also had to include either surgical findings or CT as the reference standard. Now, this was an individual patient data meta-analysis, so that means that the authors got together with the original trial authors and obtained patient-level data, which lets them sort of synchronize the data and standardize the definitions and do a better job of looking at subgroups as well. So ultimately, they found five studies, of which four could provide data on all of the participants, a little over 400 patients. Two of the studies provided most of the patients, 354. Overall, the studies were low risk of bias. POCUS was overall 89% accurate, 83% sensitive, and 93% specific. The positive and negative likelihood ratios were 12 and 0.2. So that's very good. I mean, that's, as tests go, that's in the very good, very helpful range. The data were somewhat heterogeneous. Is that how you say it? The I squared, which is, whatevs. So the I squared was 73%, which is significant heterogeneity. The residents were less accurate than the fellows and attendings. In terms of the heterogeneity, the main difference was lower sensitivity for residents, 73 versus 88%. So they missed more cases of small bowel obstruction versus specificity, which was more important for the ruling out, 88 versus 91%. So really no difference there. And the heterogeneity was in the specificity studies. The biggest study had very good specificity, The second biggest study had moderately good specificity. So the finally, POCUS was less accurate and also in patients with a BMI greater than 30. So bottom line, POCUS is accurate, I think quite accurate in diagnosing small bowel obstruction in adults, especially in more experienced hands. It's less accurate in adults with a BMI greater than 30, but seems like another potential good use for POCUS. Gary?
Yeah, I agree. And I really like those negative predictive values. It would be interesting to combine the pretest probability clinical estimate with the characteristics of the test to see how well they did. And I think the negative predictive value is probably more important because that's probably going to, triage the patient more effectively to either, okay, it's safe to go home or you need to come into the hospital. I love this study. I thought the patient, the individual level data as opposed to using aggregate data from these studies really strengthened the results. I do agree that confidence intervals were quite wide, however. So, the precision is actually not as good as you would hope, but still pretty darn good. And again, what is this though? This basically saves the patient a CAT scan, as far as I can tell. So,
which, as I now know, costs $3,200 if you have no insurance. So, yeah. And Kate, any other comments about this one?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'm glad we finally have something to use POCUS for. Kidding there. POCUS, of course, is taking over. I think that for me, among the more interesting things are the point that experience matters. So residents being less accurate than fellows and attendings, that's not surprising. But, from my world in medical education, I do kind of wonder if there is sort of an experience threshold or almost a pathway to sort of that point where you can say, okay, now you're diagnostically reliable enough to be able to go forth and thinking about, sort of building those pathways. Because I do think POCUS is important, not only for the cost things that we've been talking about, but also for the accessibility. So, knowing that we can say, okay, we can do this point of care versus you have to make an appointment, you have to go through a different pathway. This can take, a couple of days to a couple of weeks, or we can know right now what's wrong with you and what we're going to do about it.
Yeah, I guess you could look at how many of these exams the typical resident has done compared with the typical fellow or attending and get some sense of what number is needed to get that experience. So good stuff. Okay, thank you. Gary, gastroparesis.
Sure, I've got a study that was published in Journal of Gastroenterology earlier this year on the efficacy and safety of drugs for gastroparesis, systematic review and meta-analysis. Bottom line is nothing works. So cut to the chase here. The gastroparesis, those of us who do a lot of clinical care see this not infrequently, particularly with patients with diabetic gastroparesis. The estimate is about 5 million people in the U.S. actually have this, most of which are due to diabetes. Previous systematic reviews have examined treatments for gastroparesis, but none have done this type of network meta-analysis in using these indirect comparisons. So this particular study pooled data from 29 randomized controlled trials, just south of 4,000 patients, to assess efficacy and safety of various drugs for treating gastroparesis. I might add several of these drugs are not available in the United States. The study showed that none of the available treatments, now again, they also looked at medications that were not available in the United States. One I've never heard of called Clebopride, Domperidone, which I'm familiar with, is a Canadian drug, and then Metoclopramide is probably the one that I was raised on as well. And so when they looked at this, basically that there was really no effective treatment for gastroparesis. The study was really done pretty well. It was a fairly rigorous systematic review methodology. Multiple subgroup and sensitivity analyses were kind of confirmed the robustness, essentially, of the findings. And they assessed both the efficacy and the safety endpoints. Most trials had a higher unclear risk of bias. Differences in patient population trial methods certainly could have influenced the results, et cetera. So I think it's kind of consistent with my clinical experience. Some of these drugs do have serious side effects. Metoclopramide, Reglan, I guess the trade name that we've used over the years. I think Sisapride was one that I was brought up onto a number of decades ago. It was taken off the market. So this really does reinforce the need for more study in this area. It's a miserable condition for patients, and we really don't have that effective therapy, at least pharmacotherapy.
Yeah, we need some monoclonal antibodies, Kate.
something really expensive. We know that expensive medicines tend to work a little better, and ideally injectable, which also tend to work a little bit better. I think, Gary, you're sort of getting at this prevention, probably the best treatment for this, and just sort of prepping patients that once you have it, we don't really have great treatments for it, other than some lifestyle modifications, right? Small, regular meals. Yeah. Henry?
Yeah, so this was the focus of our quiz a few episodes ago. At least the answer was, and so as Gary and you have mentioned, that pharmacotherapy is just generally disappointing at best, and so the American Gastroenterologic Association, their recommendation, without presenting any data, is to use those small, frequent meals. And, we don't have, at least I'm not aware of data that shows that that actually works. It certainly makes sense from a practical perspective. We also presented some things about those patients with diabetic gastroparesis, that there was a cohort study with 10 years of follow-up that showed that in spite of some modest improvements in overall glycemic control, that symptoms were remarkably stable over a 10-year period. So we do need to be aware that these patients may not get all that much benefit from glycemic control. And so the whole big question is, how do we prevent them from getting diabetes in the first place? That's a whole other can of worms.
Okay, that's our can of worms for the week. How about the quiz answer, Henry?
All right. So in September, the FDA's advisory committee released its conclusions about phenylephrine. Which of the following statements about that release are true? A, phenylephrine is harmful to humans and animals. B, it's harmful to children. C, phenylephrine does not shorten the duration of colds. And D, phenylephrine is ineffective in alleviating nasal congestion. So there are lots of over-the-counter medications, including phenylephrine, are sold because they have an ingredient that the FDA considers as GRACE, G-R-A-S-E, generally recognized as safe and effective. And that has to be all documented in appropriate labeling and over-the-counter monographs. So the FDA's advisory panel had a meeting in September of this year to discuss the effectiveness of oral phenylephrine either as a single ingredient or in combination with others. They looked at new data on the effectiveness of oral phenylephrine and said, you know what? The current scientific data do not support the recommended dosage of orally administered phenylephrine, that it's not effective as a decongestant, if you will. They did not raise any concerns about safety issues, by the way, and the advisory does not address whether or not it shortens the duration of colds. So since nothing really shortens the duration of colds, in spite of the data that are quite mixed on echinacea and zinc, several other options that the FDA panel does mention, which includes using acetaminophen or ibuprofen for physical discomfort and topical decongestants, including topical phenylephrine for nasal decongestants. So, by the way, at least in October, CVS and maybe several other pharmacies have announced that they are pulling phenylephrine-containing products from the shelves. So the correct answer here is D, that phenylephrine is not effective in alleviating nasal congestion symptoms.
So I'm gonna say C and D. Because phenylephrine doesn't do anything, it doesn't shorten the duration, I'm guessing.
Well, but that wasn't addressed in the FDA.
And maybe harmful.
Yeah, but you're right. Yeah.
You know, it's harmful to your wallet, at least, if nothing else. But thanks, Henry. All right. Yeah, we'd heard about this. Apparently, this has been brewing for a long time, and there were some people, groups who were quite, working hard to get this done, and it just took forever for the FDA to kind of look at the data and say, oh yeah, okay, it doesn't really work. Topical, yes. Oral, not so much.
I think if you've ever taken it, you know immediately that it doesn't work. Like if you've taken it compared to like Sudafed, which I've been taking all week. Like
that's the good stuff.
You absolutely know that it doesn't work.
Yeah, plus you can make meth with it. I mean, what's
that's
not
right.
to like?
That's why you have to show your driver's license and ask the pharmacist for it.
The blue stuff, yeah. All right, so IAFP.com for CME credit. Go to their online education webpage. We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Tell your friends about Primary Care Update. We'll talk to you soon with more Primary Care Updates, and enjoy the game this weekend and go blue. Sorry, had to get that in there with these MSU people. All right.